February 8th. We have a fairly long agenda, so we want to get moving through it. Now, just to give you a little roadmap here first, we're going to do measure introductions, then a work session on House Bill 2357, defer action on House Bill 2492 till probably the end of the agenda, and then take the other bills up in the order in which they are listed here on the printed agenda. Colleagues, you have, as under our first item here, the measure introduction. You have before you LCs 1413, 1415, 2478, 2479, and 2480, which I would like a motion for to introduce as committee bills, recognizing, of course, that this doesn't do any say anything about the merits or the reaction that the committee will hold for these bills when they are actually come to hearing.
Mr. Chair, I move those bills be introduced as committee bills.
Representative,
do you have the numbers?
No, that's all right. I'll just recite it. Representative Barker moves LC 1413, 1415, 2478, 2479, and 2480 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll. Representative Bonamici. Aye. Representative Cameron. Aye. Representative Flores. Aye. Representative Krieger. Aye. Representative Reed. Aye. Vice Chair Barker. Aye. Vice Chair Wisden. Aye. Chair McPherson. Aye. House bills 1413, 1415, 2478, 2479, and 2480 are introduced as committee bills. I will now open a work session on House Bill 2357. Council Cummingson.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2357-3 deletes the provision in 2357 that allows the Chief Justice to promulgate rules permitting electronic transmission for service of a summons, complaint, or petition. It provides instead that the Justice may promulgate rules for the electronic service of a document other than service of a summons or an initial complaint or petition. The amendments clarifies that the state court administrator may establish procedures, not rules, regarding the destruction of documents.
Colleagues, this was before us once before, and the I think that the preparation of that amendment was described. Any questions about that amendment or about the underlying bill to get refreshed on it? Then we will I will entertain a motion on House Bill, actually on the Dash 3 amendments. Those are the current. Oh, Representative Krieger.
Chair, I'll move the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2357.
Representative Krieger has moved the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2357. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the Dash 3s are in.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2357 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger has moved House Bill 2357 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, is that too complicated to go on the consent calendar?
It's not that it is of a technical nature, but I think that the going to e-filing is such that a significant enough change that it may be perceived that way. I think it'd be better to have a little bit of explanation of that on the floor. Any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative
Koch? She is excused for the moment, and I hope she returns in time to vote before the vote's closed. Okay.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye.
What we'll do is close the work session on House Bill 2350. Oh, here she is. Representative Kopp, we have a motion before us to we've moved the Dash 3 amendments into the bill already.
Okay.
On a unanimous consent vote, and we now are voting on a motion to move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and everyone else has voted.
Aye.
And now everyone has voted.
Thank you.
House Bill 2357 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Krieger, would you be willing to carry that?
Yeah.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2357. As I indicated before, we're going to go forward to House Bill 2345. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2345. Council Tomlinson.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2345 provides that a dog owner in a civil action for medical expenses arising from an injury caused by the dog may not raise as a defense that the owner could not foresee that the dog would cause the injury. The bill preserves any other defense that may be available to the owner, such as that the dog was provoked.
Sarah Weidenhaft? Weidenhaft, I beg your pardon. If you could come forward that would be terrific. Could you both please introduce the issue?
I should refer to him as Representative Lowell, not Arnie. Good morning, Chair McPherson. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Rep from District 1, and I'm here today to support House Bill 2345. This bill eliminates a lack of foreseeability at the defense in an action of medical expense against the dog owner of a dog that caused injury. In recent years, we have seen an increase in the incidence of dog bites involving large dogs and dogs of certain breeds, and it actually can apply to a very small dog that can cause a lot of damage. You'll hear today from Sarah, I believe it's Weidenhoff, a victim of a vicious dog bite incident, specifically as to the expense she and her family have experienced for the reconstruction surgery. Passing of this bill cannot help Sarah, but she hopes that the passage of this bill will protect children and others who are victim of dog bites. Extreme medical expenses she and her family have experienced. And I'll leave it there. This constituent, I believe, is one of Representative Roblin's constituents, and I know he'd like to speak to it.
Chair McPherson, committee, my name for the record is Arnie Roblin, Representative District 9, Coos Bay. I've known the Weidenhoffs for a long time. Their son was a kindergarten student with my wife and went to the high school when I was principal. When this, I guess, accident occurred and she was bit, shortly after that, or a while after she'd been through a couple operations and realized that the law allows basically a first bite is free in the state of Oregon. And it goes back all the way to English law that came with the immigrants to this country and became part of our law system. And many states have now made the decision to change this and recognize that owners of dogs have a responsibility. And this bill just extends that responsibility to paying the medical bills of people. In this particular case, after that was all discovered, there was health insurance, and so they've been able to deal with it. But there are people who may get bitten who have no insurance, and as you're going to hear from testimony from Sarah, this is extensive injuries that can be caused by one dog bite, and I believe that the responsibility of ownership of those animals and training them correctly is an important aspect, and that the responsibility should be vested with the people who take ownership of these animals. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to all of you. And we both stand ready for some questions, but Sarah is a great person to ask some questions of.
Any questions of our legislative colleague? Apparently not. So, gentlemen, Linda, Ms. Weidenhoff, could you come forward, please, and start out by identifying yourself for the record, as you heard the others do.
Huh.
Good morning, Chairman McPherson and committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Wiedenhaft, and I'm here to support House Bill 2345. The incident happened 19 months ago, almost 19 months ago. I had stopped by the store. I wasn't working, but I had stopped by the store to get some change, to go to a flea market. You know, they don't want to take checks. And a customer had come into the store to pay their bill. I hadn't seen her in a very, very long time. They were in the back parking lot of the store, and the passenger's door was open on their pickup, extended cab pickup, crew cab pickup. I approached the vehicle. I had called her name, but she didn't hear me because she was in a conversation with her husband. And she's one of these really spooky people. If she sees a reptile, she runs to the end of the house screaming, you know, that sort of thing. Anyway, when she had stopped talking to her husband, she started turning back into her seat, and she caught a glimpse of me out of the corner of her eye, and she went, So as way of apology, I said, I'm so sorry that I startled you. And I leaned in to hug her. She had her arms open to receive my hug, her dog in the back seat, which I didn't even know was there because of the tinted glass. Did not understand that she was accepting my hug and came over her shoulder. I didn't see the dog until he had my lip in his mouth. And I still have recurring nightmares of these big golden eyes. I've had four surgeries. The fourth one went backwards. The center of my lip died and fell out. And now I have the last picture in your packet is a textbook diagram from my doctor showing the surgery that I'm going to be having on the 13th. They're going to remove the scar tissue in the center of my upper lip. And because I've lost over 30% of my upper lip, they can't do anything more with the tissue surrounding that area, so they're going to take the tissue from my lower lip, leaving it attached to the artery that supplies blood to that part of my lower lip intact so that it can supply the blood to the graft into the upper lip. My lips are going to be sealed for 3 to 4 weeks, so I'll be on a liquid diet. Then there'll be a procedure to separate my lips and reconstruct the lip line. So that's what I've got coming up. And this will be fifth, sixth, and I don't know how many surgeries beyond that for scar revision. It's each time, of course, I have to learn to talk over again because I lose my M's and my P's and I learn to substitute words. I guess when I found out that... I assumed when it happened that insurance would cover it and everything would be fine. I pressed no charges against the owners. I did not have the dog destroyed. I realized that it was a misunderstanding. I also understand that dogs have been humanized by their owners. They've now become part of the families instead of an animal. They're considered children. If my son were to put a baseball through somebody's window, I'd have to pay for it. That window is an inanimate object. It has no feelings. It has no value other than a dollar sign. If a dog comes in on my pasture and kills my sheep, if I can trace that dog to the owner, I can take them to court and get 3 times the value of my sheep. But so far, my surgeries are in excess of $66,000. And I'm still not fixed. And their insurance company, through a PIP, paid a whole whopping amount of $5,000, which my insurance company took off of the bottom line, so I was still responsible for all of my deductibles and all of my copays. Fortunately, as Representative Roblin said, I'm used to calling him Arnie, I'm sorry. as he said, sure. I do have insurance.
You should hear what we call him.
This is a law that came over on the Mayflower. It's a provincial law. It was established in England in the 1600s. certainly I would think that our government could understand that we separate ourselves from England. And I understand that our founding fathers wanted to deal with the issues that they felt were most important when they wrote the laws for our country to establish. I can understand accepting laws that you don't have an issue with at the time. But with the fact that most people now have lost the connection and converted their pets to family instead of the pets as animals, that they have humanized their animals, and they forget that their animals do not have the reasoning skills that humans have to determine that, yes, I startled its owner, but yes, she was accepting the fact that I was apologizing. Yes, she was accepting my hug. The dog didn't understand that. And I don't blame the dog, but I wasn't only victimized by the incident, but I was victimized by the law. Because I don't think it's right that I should carry the burden of paying for my repairs for an innocent gesture of hugging a friend. Any questions?
Ms. Wiedenhoff, thank you very much for coming so far today to describe this situation. And it's, I think it's essential for us when we're trying to decide what's right for all the people of Oregon to hear a story like yours, so that we can understand in very human terms what the consequences are of the things that the words that we put on a page and in our statute books. That's really helpful to us. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Forrest.
I don't have a question, but I have a personal incident that, while not nearly as severe as yours, but it was a dog bite many years ago and left me traumatized too, so I can appreciate that ongoing recovery from that emotional trauma of it, let alone the issue that's the subject of this bill. So thank you for your testimony.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much, Ms. Wiedenhoff.
Thank you.
We have a couple of other witnesses signed up. John Powell.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, could I have Mr. Merle join me as well?
Yeah, it'd be just fine.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies, and with me is Steve Merle, a claims attorney with State Farm. Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, in 4 minutes, I have a meeting with a senator, and if you're not aware of their rules, we cannot send notes in and call him off the floor, and this meeting's been pending for over a week. So I'm going to have to throw Mr. Merle to the dogs. And you will be able to discuss this issue with him. But in general, the issue of dog bites usually ends up as a homeowner's claim. Somebody comes on to a person's property and a dog engages them at that point. In this case, we're totally unaware of this case until it was just described, happened in an automobile, and the use of an automobile, and thus automobile insurance in this case was part of the equation. I've asked Mr. Merle to kind of explain to you how homeowners coverage, and we're more prepared for that side of it, works, but he also has expertise in auto insurance, so is a good witness for you to discuss this particular issue with. But in general, this legislation will move dog bites into a strict liability arena. And I'll have Mr. Merle go over that information with you.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Merle. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of State Farm Insurance. I provide advice both to our automobile portion of our operation and the homeowners part of our operation. I just want to kind of give you maybe a little background on how dog liability works and how the insurance industry fits into that as a risk transfer mechanism. Usually, as Mr. Powell described, it's going to be the homeowner's coverage that provides coverage for a dog bite. And essentially what happens in the present-day contracts is that not only do we insure you, but we insure animals that are either owned by you or in your charge that end up causing injury to someone. The current law has been pretty much described. Essentially, dogs right now are presumed not to be vicious unless they have displayed some sort of vicious propensity in the past. That's often called the first bite is free, although it's not necessarily completely accurate. There are other types of vicious behavior that could put you on notice that a dog is vicious or potentially going to bite someone. When you have that kind of notice, you're potentially liable. If you don't have that kind of notice under current law, you're not liable for what the dog does. With some exceptions. So there can be some exceptions where you let dogs at large that are kind of a different sort of scenario, but that is generally what happens with dogs now. Right now, we insure dogs until they display a vicious propensity. Typically, if we know of a dog having displayed a vicious propensity, we will underwrite by either charging more for that policy, or in some cases, if it's bad enough, we'll go ahead and say, we'll continue to insure you as a homeowner so long as the dog identified by name and breed is excluded from the policy. And when that happens, it drops out of an insurance company then having the transfer of liability in handling this claim to the person being personally responsible themselves. One of the reasons that Mr. Powell and I felt like it was important to talk to you about this bill, because if it goes forward, the dog liability will be expanded. In the years that John and I have worked together, we have not had a single legislative session go by where there's not a constituent inquiry where someone is concerned because either they can't get homeowners insurance without a dog exclusion, or else there's some sort of pricing difference in their coverage because of the dog they have. So there's pushback that happens that way, too, because just even the small premium increase that it would have with the exclusion where it's now my personal liability instead of being able to transfer that to an insurer is an issue that comes up with people. And we'd like you to know that's going to happen. The other thing is, if this does happen where it goes forward and the liability is expanded, we'd like to see an amendment to the bill that preserves the current types of ways we have to underwrite for dogs, so that when we become aware of a vicious dog, or State Farm doesn't follow this model, but some other companies do, where they will look at breeds of dogs statistically on how often they are to bite, when they bite, what kind of damage they do. I describe that sometimes as kind of like that you'll hear different ideas of whether a breed of dog has a propensity to bite or not. What's probably not a dispute is if a pit bull bites, more often than not, it's going to be more of a problem than if a dachshund bites, just because a larger dog has more ability to do more damage. But we wanted you to be aware of those things as you're making this decision, and also just to kind of preserve our ability to underwrite. And with that, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to handle.
Representative Krieger, when you have that insurance, what about the dog that's off the property of the owner? In other words, it's down the block somewhere and it attacks some kid on a bike and does similar damage or worse. Are they covered then? And what about the licensing of the dog? If it's licensed, does that make a difference?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, the answer to your question, the first part of it is yes. If it's a dog that you either own or you have charge of, if it goes down the street and causes some damage, then your homeowner's insurance also applies to that loss as well if it was on your property. As far as licensing of the dog and whatnot, Oregon has followed the model of allowing local jurisdictions at the county level to have dog ordinances, and there is an eclectic mix of ordinances within the state reflecting the values of the different people living in the counties as to what triggers liability. In some cases, if a dog is at large, out of control of the owner, it's almost strict liability. Those tend to be the western Oregon counties where there's higher proportion of urban population. The eastern Oregon counties, dogs are virtually unregulated except for when they kill livestock, which kind of reflects the value that you have in that part of the country.
How does that work where you have a person who is renting from somebody, they don't have any insurance, and does the landlord then assume the responsibility of the person's dog?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, there's actually a reported case that I cannot recall the name of right now, but essentially that falls under the Landlord-Tenant Act, and the decision of the court was is if the landlord is on notice of the tenant maintaining a vicious dog, there's potential for liability. But the plaintiff or the person making the claim in that case would have to actually show that and prove it as a fact.
So what you're saying is unless they could prove that, in other words, if this incident where there is no prior record, they wouldn't be able to have a claim because they couldn't show that the person knew or should have known, and then they're going to be liable. And that gets back to the thing I was talking about is we've discussed, you know, Representative Roblin and I and Sarah and her husband, is that if you aren't covered by insurance and you have children and they're out on the street, I would assume that a lot of the bites take place in that type of thing. A kid going by on a bike and the dog kicks after the kid on the bike. I can remember getting bit when I was a kid on a bike. Those people are going to have no protection unless we make substantial changes here.
Chairman McPherson and Representative Krieger, I'm trying to make sure I respond to your question appropriately. In the situation of the landlord, it's true that the landlord would not have, under current law, responsibility without notice of the vicious dog. Now, the tenant themselves has the same liability today. The tenant also has to know about the dog's vicious propensities, what we often describe as the one free bite rule. That tenant may have a tenant homeowner's insurance policy. They may not. It depends on different choices people make, and sometimes that's also just a fact of what their economic situation is. If that tenant has that tenant homeowner's policy, that's going to provide coverage for the dog. I think what this legislation does potentially do, though, is now it exposes some landlords to at least the medical expenses, because the foreseeability is now going to be removed as a defense, and I think the logical extension of that is landlords would have more liability today.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Merle, I want to just ask a question about how this bill, if passed, would work practically. In case that we heard, in Sarah's case, if this bill passed the way that it is, with or without the amendments, would the dog owner's insurance have just paid her medical expenses, or would she have to bring a civil action and then recover that way? Or if the bill passes, are insurance companies just going to say, well, we should pay these claims because we know that foreseeability is not a defense anymore?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, there's a variety of things that can happen. First of all, as an optional coverage, most homeowners' policies carry what's called medical payments coverage. It's usually a small amount of money. I think you heard the previous witness testify that PIP, which is a no-fault medical coverage on cars, started out handling her bills up to a certain point. That coverage has a time limit as well as a dollar limit. Under homeowners' policies, with no fault, the dog bite for $1,000 to $5,000, depending on which coverage that insured selected, would pay regardless of fault for medical expenses. After that, it becomes a liability claim. And what happens as insurers, we investigate the liability. If we determine that our insured has an exposure and it's a claim for settlement, then we'll try to go about negotiating a settlement, and that's where the funds for the medical expenses would come for. Do you advance pay those prior to a settlement? That's a difficult issue to come across. There's some Oregon case law that I think is still good that kind of indicates if a liability carrier advance pays money, they run the risk of negligent claim handling. If the advance pays so much of the money they have in their limits out that they no longer have the money left to have a settlement. There's a case out there that was reversed on other grounds, but I think that that still is in effect. So basically, you would be looking at paying for the medical damages when you arrive at a settlement.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Morrell? Representative Barker.
I'm just thinking, sometimes I have my kids, I don't own a dog, but my kids do, and sometimes I have their dog, and one of them who I brought down here is this big, friendly, big yellow lab. And I'm amazed when I take him out for a walk in the neighborhood or something, or at the store, and he's hard and sick. And people will let these little children run right up to the dog. And he's a very gentle dog, but I could see where a dog in that case might snap at a kid. And if you could help me, you said you'd like to see an amendment. What would the amendment do?
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, it would just basically permit us to underwrite based on being in ownership or in charge of a dog. And I think there could be a lot of business models. Typically in the insurance industry, as many companies as we have underwriting business models. Some companies may choose to handle this by rating, and that could be rating could be based on whether you have a dog or not. It could be based on not only whether you have a dog or not, what the breed would be. There could be another business model that would say that at certain points in time, either at the beginning of the policy or once we learn some stuff, that we would no longer cover whatever dog that is that we know about. Typically, the exclusions I've seen is it says, you know, Skippy, a fox terrier, age whatever, and that's the dog that's excluded. It's not generally not a blanket exclusion. It's a specific dog.
Okay, thank you.
Let me just pursue that. Mr. Merrill, would you need a change in the statute to be able to design exclusions? I mean, isn't an insurance company free to deny dog coverage entirely or to decide on what conditions or circumstances the company would provide coverage to dogs?
Chair McPherson, I'm not exactly sure because I'd have to go back into the underwriting statutes. Generally, we do have some freedom to underwrite. I guess the thing we're asking now is the expansion of liability comes forward, that it's clear that this body considered insurance and said, yeah, we know that there's a risk transfer here, and we need to allow the insurers to have freedom so that in conjunction with the bill, it's clear that that was something that was considered as part of the public policy when the bill passed.
Okay. Council Kelmanson.
If there's as the law is now, if there's a civil action and a court finds that the dog had a vicious propensity or however they use the term, as insurance is written now, would that mean that the owner's insurance would no longer cover that claim, wouldn't pay that claim?
Chair McPherson, Council Kelmanson, not always. What happens is that initial claim where we don't know about a dog having vicious propensities and we end up covering that claim. It would be future claims that we're talking about. So that if you decide you're going to maintain Skippy after he's really bit somebody bad, and that's a personal choice you've made, then we need to be able to have some sort of mechanism for saying, you know, that's maybe not a good risk transfer unless we charge for it, or maybe we decide that Skippy's the kind of dog that we just can't insure.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Merrill. We have Sean Miller signed up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I represent the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America. PCI is a trade association of property casualty insurance companies with over 200 companies that do business in the state of Oregon. Steve did a good job of just describing what our concerns are with the bill. As you consider this bill moving forward in a strict liability format to consider the insurance side and underwriting, and what I have passing around is a report that was been done talking about the breeds of dogs and the fatal human attacks for the last 20 years. It's a good background, I believe, material for you as you contemplate this, because you know the stories that obviously we've heard in the cases. This kind of outlines some of the importance as you consider the insurance side. And you know, essentially every 40 seconds someone in the United States seeks medical attention for a dog bite related injury. Dog attacks cause about 4.5 million injuries annually, 800,000 of which require that medical attention. There, in the study, you'll see that there's about 25 different breeds of dogs that have been involved in these bite related fatalities in the United States. And interestingly enough, pit bulls and Rottweilers account for over half of these deaths and many of the injuries. And so one of the business models that many of the insurance companies take, because especially as you look at this report, is some will actually have breed-specific exemptions in there. And when you read this, we believe rightfully so. It does present a risk, and the data shows that it presents that risk. And so 24% of the human deaths involve the unrestrained dogs off their owner's property. I think that was the question Representative Krieger asked. And about 58% of the human deaths involved unrestrained dogs on the owner's property itself. And so,
you know, with over 50% of those bites occurring on the dog owner's property, you know, the issue is a major concern for insurers. In 2005, dog bites cost insurers $317.2 million, and in the cost of the average dog bite claim rose from roughly $16,600 in 2002 to $21,200 in 2005. Now, obviously, the case you just heard before you is quite a bit larger than that. That was the average. And, you know, many insurance companies, as Steve said, insure the homeowners and the renters with dogs. There's homeowners and renters policies, and they'll accommodate those in their, you know, in those policies. But they may exclude certain breeds or, you know, focus on the individual's dog behavior, which is that, again, that first bite theory that you heard earlier. You know, if the dog bites someone, most insurers recognize that it is an increased risk and either charge the higher premium, suggest the homeowner find a dog a new home, unfortunately, or non-renew the policy or actually exclude that dog from the policy. And from all the companies, it ranges all over the map on what they may do. And so, obviously, as a customer of insurance, you can choose different insurance companies based on how they may underwrite. But I think the message that we're trying to tell you today is moving from that strict liability or to a strict liability within this bill, there will be some changes in the insurance industry. I think you will possibly see more exclusions. You'll look at some of the data in this report, and I think you'll see more underwriting and a harder look at how people with dogs, because it does provide a risk. And as Steve described, the liability above that, if this were to go forward, would be borne obviously upon the owner of that dog. And I just wanted to, you know, provide that background. One of the other interesting points as I read this article, which I think it's a good report, just to provide some good background on breeds of dogs. And I don't know if many of you read Vet Med today, except for Senator Schrader probably, but it was one of the things over the last 10 years. There's been a shift in the breeds that are owned by individuals, and Rottweilers have risen from 15th to the most owned dog to the second most popular dog in the United States. And so, you know, as the shift, and I gave you just a little bit of background of how some of our claims have gone up costs, we can prove the correlation, obviously, in that. And, again, that is a risk upon the insurer that we have to consider as we're underwriting that individual with these kind of dogs. And so I just wanted to lay that out for background, and as you consider this and move forward with this particular bill, it's important that we are still able to underwrite appropriately. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Krieger.
I like the report. I appreciate that, Sean. Bottom of page, left side, 79 through 96, 300 human beings were killed by dogs. I think that's a greater number than I would have expected. Mm-hmm. I think probably the number per year, because of the larger dogs, as you said, ownership is going to increase. We're going to have more fatalities. And I would suspect that the greater number of those is probably children.
There actually is, it references in the study that the majority, and let me find the...
Top of the page. And I think what it really does, Chair, it actually strengthens the fact that we do need to change the present law in Oregon, that someone is going to be responsible. Specifically, I believe, I was reading the statute the other day, there's a different section in Oregon law that covers a dog that causes fatality. And that's not what we're dealing with. We're dealing with injury. And there is another mechanism for these types of dogs already that's in statute, and I would assume, since it's in Oregon statute, they're dealing with it presently in the insurance field.
Any other questions for Mr. Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Miller. I have no other witnesses signed up on House Bill 2345. This obviously is a complex issue. Will require some further work, but appreciate those who came forward. And once again, Ms. Wiedenhoff, thank you very much for coming. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2345, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2129.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The committee, House Bill 2129 comes to you from the Attorney General's office and removes the 5% limitations for administrative costs for the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund. You have the dash one amendments in front of you, which basically increase the expenses that they can charge from 5% to 10%. If I remember correctly, at a hearing we heard that the actual expenses are about 9%. And I believe Ronell Schenkel is here from the Department of Justice if you have any further questions.
And members, according to my notes, I have 8.5% as the current figure on that. So we have sort of a compromise approach rather than the original bill that would have simply removed the 5% limitation on administrative costs. It would instead move it from 5% to 10%.
Mr. Chair?
Represented by
Mr.
Chair. Do you
have the dash one amendment? And I don't seem to have it. No.
It should be in your packet.
Apologies. Well, now that you say that, Representative Bonamici, I'm looking for my copy.
No,
of
I don't have it.
No.
I don't see if you have any copy of it, so if you have one handy there.
I just gave mine away.
Okay.
We just missed it. We were talking about them last time. If I could look on.
I don't have.
Okay. We'll have copies of the dash one amendments currently with us momentarily. So why don't we, we'll just, no one else had. Yes, we have just a couple of copies of the dash one, so. But I wanted to just describe it to you here, colleagues. It would, in lines 6 through 10 of the printed bill, would restore the bracketed material. So the deletions you see in the original printed bill would be restored. And then on line 9, the word 5 would be replaced with 10. Now that you have the text of the amendment before you, is there any discussion about this proposed amendment or the bill generally?
The dash one amendments into the bill.
Representative Wisnett has moved the dash one amendments into House Bill 2129. Is there any objections? Dash ones are in.
That was my only concern when the bill was before. We were eliminating the 5 and not setting an admin cap, and now it sets the cap of 10. So.
Right.
I move that we pass or vote yes from House Bill 2129. We would do pass recommendation, including the dash one amendments, on the consent agenda.
Are you people comfortable with the consent agenda on this one?
Yes.
I may be seeing a contrary expression here.
If the consensus of the committee is that it would be appropriate, but since we are increasing a cap for administrative expense, it might be well just to have a little bit of definition.
I'm inclined to agree with Representative Flores. And you know, I think the consent agenda is really properly used for things that are purely technical and wouldn't raise in anybody's mind on reading the description of the bill any policy issues. So I think it's
I'll remove my recommendation for consent agenda.
Very good. Representative Wisnett has moved House Bill 2129 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Cost?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye.
House Bill 2129, as amended, is moved to the House with a due pass recommendation. Representative Wisnant, would you carry that bill?
I thought Flores wanted to carry it.
Well,
I'll carry it.
Okay, thank you, sir. Closing work session on House Bill 2129. A public hearing on House Bill 2359.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2359 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar. Elderly law section clarifies the preference for surviving spouses to bank account of his or her deceased spouse when the amount is less than $25,000 applies to a deposit or person whose death occurs on or after the effective date of the 2007 Act.
We have Ryan Gibb from the Oregon State Bar Elder Law section here with us. Mr. Gibb.
Thank you.
Chairman Pearson, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Gibb. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify in favor of House Bill 2359. I am an attorney in private practice here in Salem, and I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar Elder Law Section, not the Elderly Law Section. I'm not quite there yet, but part of the practice of the Elder Law Section routinely involves dealing with situations where a spouse has passed away and may have a bank account in their individual name. The surviving spouse or surviving children don't have the resources or the value of the account is not significant enough to justify opening a full probate or even maybe even going through the small estate process. The banking statutes that are referenced in 2359 for amendment allow an heir or the State of Oregon Department of Human Services Estate Administration Unit to file an affidavit of heirship with the bank that would allow them then to have access to and gather up those funds, provided that they are less than $25,000 in aggregate. The problem that we see in Oregon is that the reference statutes are not completely in alignment. The three different statutes deal with different types of banking institutions. These statutes were brought into place at different periods of time. Thank you, sir. There is an unfortunate practice where a surviving spouse may go to the bank or to the financial institution, file the affidavit, but not be allowed to access those funds for a period in order to allow the estate administration section an opportunity to file their affidavit. That's a problem because in a situation where there's a surviving spouse, the practice of the estate administration unit and the administrative rules do not allow them to capture those funds. Those funds are allowed to go to the surviving spouse if that person was receiving public benefits such as Medicaid. Nevertheless, the surviving spouse may go to the bank and be denied access to those funds for a period of time because the bank wants to give the estate administration section the opportunity to file that claim. The purpose of the amendments in House Bill 2359 would be to clarify the process across all three different sets of banking statutes that are referenced, to create a uniform process and to make it clear that if there's a surviving spouse, that surviving spouse has the first 45 days to go and access those funds to the exclusion of anybody else. After that 45th day, a state administration section can step in and request those funds if there is no surviving spouse. If there's no claim from the estate administration section, then other heirs, as appropriate and as listed there, could step in and request those funds. But essentially what we request is that those first 45 days be carved out for a surviving spouse, so the surviving spouse doesn't have to come back later and ask the estate administration section to refund or to provide those funds to them when they shouldn't have been collected in the first place, because state administration section wouldn't have pursued that claim. The proposed amendments would not decrease the overall recovery by the estate administration section, because these situations where a surviving spouse would be allowed that period of time are situations where the estate administration section would not enforce their claim anyway, or would refund those funds back to the surviving spouse. So there's no net loss to the state of Oregon. And in fact, we can avoid some of those circumstances where the estate administration section has to go through the administrative process of identifying the funds that were captured, that shouldn't have been captured, and processing a refund and then getting that back out to the surviving spouse. The estate administration section and I request that this committee move this to the full house with a do pass recommendation. I am available to answer any questions.
Testimony. Mr. Gibb, I noticed we specified in the bill the timeline for the spouse and for the department, and there's no timeline for the other. I take it there's no need to specify timeline for the other sort of priority claims that follow on after the Department of Human Services.
Chair McPherson, the intent, and I believe the reading of the proposed amendments would be that the surviving spouse has the first 45 days from the death of the depositor to file that affidavit with the banking institution, to the exclusion of anybody else. There's nobody else, estate administration section or any heirs, that would be authorized to file within that 45-day period. Beyond that 45-day period, then, it would be up to the estate administration section and then up to other heirs to pursue that deposit account.
Council Taylor. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Gibb, I take it if the surviving spouse does not file within 45 days, they can still file, they just don't get a priority. Is that correct?
Representative McPherson, Chair McPherson and Council Taylor, the surviving spouse would still have the priority claim. And they would still be able to recover those funds from the estate administration section, and their claim would still trump other heirs farther down the list. However, the impetus is on them to file within the first 45 days, or they would have to prove their claim over anybody else who might file later on.
Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gibb. The Oregon State Bar, in a paper to us, indicated the Oregon Department of Human Services may oppose this. Also, the question I have for you, they were going to oppose it based as it would delay that agency's ability to make a claim on the descendant's account using an heirship. However, any claim of the estate administration unit would remain valid and there should be no physical impact reduction recovery. Could you comment on that? And could you also comment on why $25,000? How did that number appear?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, I've actually discussed this matter with Patricia Taylor, who is with the Department of Human Services, and she indicated to me that the department did not have an objection to the statute as written. There was interest on their part in not denying the state administration unit the opportunity to file within the first 45 days. Essentially, they did not want to have to wait until the 45th day to file their claim with the bank, or the affidavit of heirship with the bank. The concern that brings up is really that provides no change to the status quo. Currently, they have the right to present the affidavit of heirship now. If there's a surviving spouse, that spouse would have to go to the estate administration section and seek a refund of those funds. We have expressed our intent to pursue this bill as it is without such an amendment. I don't, as a section, we have not, we do not believe that there is a significant burden on the estate administration section in calendaring 45 days from the date of death and waiting to that point to file that affidavit of heirship. And Patricia Taylor did not indicate that they were going to actually oppose the bill as written. They may seek an amendment, but they were not in opposition to the bill as written. And with regards to the second question, the limit of $25,000 has been in play or in place since long before I came around. So I can't explain exactly why. The intent, my understanding is that we don't include too large of an amount of funds. This process bypasses any court supervision, bypasses any public notice, any notice to the state of Oregon, and allows a person simply to walk into a bank and with appropriate identification and appropriate notice that they are an heir to withdraw these funds. By increasing that amount, we would be encroaching on amounts that are probably more appropriately handled through a regular state proceeding, whether it be a small estate or a full probate.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You may.
Thank you, sir. So if there's $50,000 in there, could the spouse draw $25,000 out?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, no. The aggregate limit is $25,000 across all deposit accounts.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Barker.
If I understand this, I'm just trying to make this clear. So if there's the sole parent is the decedent and two brothers have a right, so one of them decides if I beat my brother, I get the $25,000, what happens then?
Chair McPherson and Representative Barker, my expectation is they would need to go find attorneys. and not to be flippant about that at all. But essentially, at that point, it is up to the brother who would be signing the affidavit and presenting that to the bank is acknowledging that it would have to acknowledge the existence of any other heirs of a similar class, and they would have to acknowledge to the bank that they would be dividing that appropriately. Whether or not they do is a matter of between the brothers.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Forrest.
Mr. Chair, I think it's important that we realize that in this type of situation, the $25,000 limit usually is not the level at which there are going to be funds available. This is primarily to protect the interests of a surviving spouse, a widower who needs access to funds, but doesn't reach the limit of either a small estate proceeding, which at one point was $50,000 or more, or full probate, which is in excess of that. So it's not to get to, and there is then a series of who could have access once the surviving spouse is taken care of, and it goes to the Department of Human Services and then on to other relatives. So I think this is specifically to protect the interests of someone who would be left with some funds to sustain, but does not reach the level of the small estate proceeding or full probate.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you probably want to look at subsection D on page 1-2. The affidavit shall embody a promise to pay the expenses of last sickness, funeral expenses, and just debts of the deceased, deposited, we're adding, out of the deposit to the full extent of the deposit if necessary, in order of the priorities described in 115-125, and to distribute any remaining monies to persons who are entitled to these monies by law. So the person receiving the money, I understand reading that correctly, is under certain legal obligations as to how they spend it. Is that correct?
Chair McPherson, Council Taylor, yes, indeed. They acknowledge in that affidavit that they will be using those funds to satisfy any just debts, essentially bypassing the probate process, but still paying any debts, any claims from the estate administration unit or any other just debts of the decedent.
Mr. Gibb, what would happen if the surviving spouse received the money under the statute and didn't do so? That left a debt unpaid, for example, of the decedent.
Chairman Pearson, in general, this may be an overgeneralization, but more often than not in the state of Oregon, a debt of one spouse is also chargeable to the surviving spouse. The chances are good that a debt for services provided, for example, services provided to a decedent, are also chargeable upon the surviving spouse. They would remain liable for that. If it is a debt that is strictly personal to the decedent, and the surviving spouse has indicated to the bank that the surviving spouse would satisfy any debts, then I believe that any creditors would have a suit or a cause of action against the surviving spouse for satisfaction of that debt, and that also would not stop a creditor or another heir from initiating either a small estate proceeding so that the court could summarily determine the administration of those funds, or even a full probate if there are other funds or assets which may need to be considered as part of the estate. So we're not cutting off any other processes. This is simply another process that can be used in lieu of a small estate or a full probate.
Further questions? Okay. And there's no one else signed up to testify. We do have a letter that was sent in from Stephen Heinrich, who is an attorney in Corvallis and is chair of the Elder Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. And I don't know if others have this letter in their packets or not. I think it likely do, but he expresses his support of this bill. He references LC 686, but that is House Bill 2359.
Mr. Chair, before Mr. Gibb leaves, I'd like to ask a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gibb. This may not be related to the bill, but as a practical matter, I know a lot of seniors tend to spread their money around into various bank accounts. Is it problematic when you're dealing with the surviving spouse to try to figure out what if they don't know if it's $25,000 and they have to sign an affidavit saying that the amount in all financial institutions is less than $25,000. Is it a practical matter? Does that cause problems?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, that is a fairly common occurrence to see people spread accounts or funds out through a variety of accounts. If the accounts that we've identified are an aggregate total of less than $25,000, then in my practice, I will recommend that the surviving spouse go ahead and sign the affidavit and submit that. If we later identify other funds which would push us over that $25,000 limit, then I believe that we'd be in violation of the statute to sign a further affidavit and try and access those funds. At that point, either a small estate proceeding or a full probate would need to be initiated in order to deal with the administration of those funds.
So then do you withdraw the affidavit? How does that work?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, essentially what my practice is would be to file the small estate affidavit, affidavit of claiming successor, or initiate a full probate and include any amounts previously captured with the affidavit of heirship as an asset of the estate. So to include those as assets of the estate, but not to return them to the individual banks.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, that concludes the public testimony on House Bill 2359. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2359 and open a work session on House Bill 2359. Colleagues, I think the only contraindication we heard was a suggestion that the Department of Human Services might be concerned about this bill. But the State Administration Unit, but they would be on notice of this hearing and didn't come forward with an amendment or concerns. It really does look like it's establishing just timelines and kind of facilitating the policy choices that are already in place. So it would seem to me a reasonable bill to move forward and to the consent calendar if you were of that mind.
And, Mr. Chair, I do think that Mr. Gibb testified that he'd had conversations that the department would not be opposing the bill, and it really would reduce the administration's expense of receiving the monies and having to return them.
And Mr. Chair, I just want to express support for the bill. I know it's a very difficult time for a grieving spouse to have to deal with the complications of waiting and not being able to meet funeral expenses. So I think this is a good bill.
Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2359 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be considered for the consent agenda.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 2359 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Cook?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye.
House Bill 2359 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. I now close the work session on House Bill 2359 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2360.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2360 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar Elder Law Section. Allows the conservator to close a trust created for a protected person if, one, the trust is created for the purposes of qualifying the protected person for needs-based government benefits or maintaining eligibility of the protected person for need-based government benefits. Two, the value of the conservatorship estate does not exceed $5,000. Three, the purpose of the estate of the conservatorship was to create the trust, or four, the conservator convinced the court that there was good reason to terminate the trust. Applies to conservatorships established prior to or on or after the effective date of the bill.
Mr. Gibb, if you could come forward again. If I realized you were first up on the next, I would have let you stay in place.
Thank you, Chairman Pearson, members of the committee. Again, my name is Ryan Gibb, attorney in private practice here in Salem, member of the Executive Committee of the Elder Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. The Elder Law Section has identified another issue of practice, which we have requested an amendment to the statutes. ORS 125.440 requires that, or does not allow, a trust to be created within a conservatorship that would have the purpose of terminating the conservatorship. Essentially, the purpose being, if a court is going to authorize the creation of a trust, the court is going to continue to supervise the administration of that trust through the conservatorship process. And those cases stay open, and regular accountings are filed, and other administrative formalities of a conservatorship are maintained. In certain cases, a conservatorship and a supplemental needs trust may be established for a person who is receiving some form of public benefits. Typically speaking, it would be supplemental security income, known as SSI, or Medicaid. If a person is receiving one of those benefits and receives perhaps an inheritance or some kind of a large back pay from Social Security, if their Social Security had not been approved for a significant period of time, they may end up with a large back payment amount, personal injury, settlement for an accident, they may end up with a sum of cash that would knock them off of those public benefit programs that they're currently entitled to. The court can create a supplemental needs trust that would allow the individual to continue to receive those public benefits. Those trusts are authorized by the Social Security Act and by Oregon statute and rule. And those statutes and rules allow the public benefits to continue to be provided to the individual as long as the funds that they receive are put into a supplemental needs trust. These trusts are what we refer to as payback trusts. When the individual passes away, what's left in the trust goes to the state for recovery, for the recoverable benefits provided to the individual. Again, typically those would be Medicaid benefits provided, and the estate administration has the first claim against any remaining balance in the trust. Oftentimes, these amounts that we're talking about are not large amounts. We may have $20,000 or $30,000 back payment from Social Security. We may have a $40,000 or $50,000 public or a personal injury award. those amounts are significant to the individual and would knock them off of their public benefit programs. By placing those amounts into the Supplemental Needs Trust, we can keep the individual on the public benefit program so that their medical care, their housing, whatever other benefits they're receiving, go uninterrupted. But the conservatorship has to stay in place under the current statutes, and the administrative expenses of filing an accounting, maintaining a bond, and frankly the administrative burden, even though it's not necessarily a huge burden to the courts, remains in place as well. So the trustee under the Supplemental Needs Trust is generally also the conservator, files an accounting every year with the court. That accounting is reviewed, any questions are answered, and then those are approved. The amendments in House Bill 2360 would allow a court to terminate the conservatorship in some limited circumstances in favor of the creation of Supplemental Needs Trust. And those circumstances are set out within the bill. If the conservatorship was created for the purpose of creating the Supplemental Needs Trust for the individual so that they could maintain their needs-based government benefits, if the value of the conservatorship is less than $50,000, and if the conservator can show good cause that, for instance, the administrative expenses are burdensome to the conservatorship estate, then the court has the authority or the option of terminating the conservatorship and allowing then a trustee to manage the Supplemental Needs Trust without continued court supervision. The benefit would be the prolonging of the funds that are available for the supplemental needs of the individual, less funds going towards the administration of the trust and a conservatorship, and more of those funds being used directly for the individual's supplemental needs. It would also have the benefit of possibly leaving some extra funds in there when the person has passed away, and creating a little bit more available for the State of Oregon Estate Administration section to recover upon their death through the payback function of that trust. The elder law section has proposed this in order to allow those circumstances where the costs may well outweigh the continued administrative burden for those conservatorships to be closed for in favor of a supplemental needs trust to allow a more efficient management of those funds. There has been a question raised by Judge Claudia Burton, who is a judge here in Marion County, as to whether or not there would be an increase in fiduciary abuse if there was a decrease in court supervision. And I can't deny that that's a possibility. We see fiduciary abuse in cases where there is court supervision, and we certainly see it in cases where there is no court supervision. That is another reason why we have suggested the relatively low amount of $50,000 as the ceiling for terminating these conservatorships, so we don't have individuals with very large amounts of money being directed into a supplemental needs trust in order to in order for a potentially poorly advised trustee to misappropriate some of the funds later on. We're talking about relatively limited amounts. We're talking about folks who are on public benefit programs who may need this money for supplemental needs, and rather than having it go towards administrative expenses of a conservatorship. I have discussed the matter briefly with Judge Burton. She and I have agreed to talk about it more in the future. She did not indicate a strong opposition or a position that she would appear and testify against the bill. But as I've said, I've yet to really have a good sit down and talk with her about it. The elder law section does request that this committee move this to the House floor with a do pass recommendation, and I am available for any questions.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. I think it's important, Mr. Gibb, that when you're talking about administrative costs in the conservatorship proceeding, that annual accounting is an involved process of getting checks, copies, filing with the court. That also involves attorney's fees, so this is not an attorney fee generating issue here. So that potentially is a drawdown in the resource available to the person that does have what we used to call special needs trust, that supplemental needs trust here. I do have agreement, though, that in regard to the trust outside the purview of the court by virtue of the conservatorship proceeding could be troublesome if you have a trustee who has a propensity to be making mischief.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gibb, are there any provisions that can be put? I don't know much about supplemental needs trust. Are there provisions that might address the fiduciary abuse possibility that could be put into the supplemental needs trust?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici. The court can require, the court can create the trust really in any fashion that they desire. There are specific requirements of such a trust, but the court can impose, for instance, a bond. That the trustee post the appropriate bond to cover any malfeasance that may happen. The court also this would not be a requirement that the court terminate these conservatorships. So if the court has questions about a given trustee slash conservator, the court can maintain this for a couple of years. The court can see how things go. And then weigh the any concerns the court has about the trustee against the administrative burden to the estate, and the court may decide to keep it open. I think it's important to note that this is available, an available option to the court, but it is not a mandate that the court definitely close these cases.
Thank you.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Thank you for your testimony, but I have to openly admit I'm lost. Why could you explain to me why a conservatory trust like this would be set up in the first place?
I can. Chair McPherson, Representative Kopp. An individual who's receiving SSI benefits,
right,
through the Social Security Administration or Medicaid benefits through the state of Oregon, there are financial limits on those programs. If the individual will not continue to qualify for the program if they have more than $2,000 in available assets, money in the bank. The Social Security Act allows for the creation of, we term them anything from a supplemental or special needs trust to a D4 trust, which references the actual statute, or a payback trust or an under 65 trust, general different names for the same thing. That trust makes these funds available for specific needs of the individual. Those funds are not available for food, they're not available for clothing, and they're not available for shelter. Those expenses are expected to be paid from the individual's SSI benefits or the other benefits they receive. So these funds are available for what we term the supplemental needs of the individual, which could be non-covered medical expenses, could be medical equipment they need. It could be specialized equipment, computer, wheelchair, special bed. It could even be therapeutic trips or any other things that are, you know, to be available for the individual. These trusts are created so that the individual can continue to receive their medical benefits or their SSI payments, and yet have this fund available for anything else that they may have need of.
Just a quick follow-up. The only way that these funds are set up is through the courts?
Chair McPherson, Representative Kopp, the Social Security Act provision that allows for these and Oregon administrative rule which governs these in Oregon allows these to be created by a parent or grandparent or by the court.
Okay,
so
thank
there
you.
Is a limitation on who can create them.
Okay. Representative Flores.
And one other element, Representative Comp, a conservatorship is a different proceeding, and that is a mechanism to watch over the assets of an individual.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions of Mr. Gibb? Thank you, Mr. Gibb.
Thank you. And Chair McPherson, if I might say, I've also provided written testimony from Penny Davis, who's an elder law attorney in Portland, and again from Stephen Heinrich, elder law attorney down in Corvallis, in support of the bill. They wish to provide written testimony on their viewpoints as well.
And actually, Representative Wisner, did you have a question before Mr. Gibb?
You might want to comment on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair, because Representative Flores has brought up some good points in the letter that we have from Stephen Hendricks talks about, again, putting safeguards on administering these funds. So, so do you have any offer to us about how we do that? In the, it's, I think it's in the middle of page two there. It's expected the courts will require appropriate safeguards to be built into any trust.
Chairman McPherson, Representative Wisnett, the safeguards generally that we would expect to be built in would primarily be a bond to, again, cover the amount that's in that trust so that if there is fiduciary malfeasance, the trustee takes off some of the money, the protected person would be covered. The court may also decide to require still an annual accounting to be provided to the beneficiary of the trust and perhaps another individual who has the ability to, if the beneficiary is incapacitated, then another person who may have the ability to review that. So without having the full formality of a formal pleading account in, that's filed with the court, there may still be an accounting that's provided that gives somebody else the ability to make sure that nothing funny is going on. Thank you very much.
Okay, and as noted before, we do have these letters, one dated January 8 from Stephen Heinrich and January 16 from Penny Davis, both members of the Elder Law Section. In fact, Mr. Heinrich identifies himself as chair of the Elder Law Section, both in support of this bill. We have one other person signed up, Bertram Kopp.
My name is Bertram Kopp. I'm a senior advocate. I've been testifying for the legislature since 1993 on elder matters. The bill in front of you, I think, is a good idea, as I've described in the handout. I hope I have enough handouts there. But there's one thing I'd like to suggest is that no limit, financial limit, be placed in the bill. It should be deleted completely because the other agencies, which have their own limitations on how much you can receive and so on, will may change. And nevertheless, we aren't going to change them by our legislation here. But you have cases where a young person may have a lifelong injury and has to be maintained under nursing home conditions or the likes. They may have a payout from an insurance policy or a damage suit, which may exceed quarter of a half $1 million. That money has to be stretched for maybe 30, 40 years. And that's why I say there should be no limitation put in the bill on the amount of money that can be transferred into the trust. Once these people are stabilized in some institution, for instance, there's no longer a reason for a court supervision of that. Once the trust is in place, the money is in place, a commercial trust officer bonded will have a responsibility to stretch those funds. If it stays in the conservatorship, it can well be milked into the pockets of somebody who is just a greedy character. I'll offer an example of my own mother. She had an income of $361 from Social Security every month. When she got into a court conservatorship, the first thing the conservator did was give $350 to her boss. And throughout the conservatorship, she continued dishing out money like, well, she didn't earn it. Why should she worry about where it went? Her friends, her boss, her husband paid for the lawyers, which was discharged from the case, and obviously mismanaged. I complained about this to the judge, and he just shrugged it off as, that's just normal courthouse procedure to strip these people, you know. Why should I worry about it? If a trust officer is appointed, that person can be sued for anything they've done. They cannot sue the court conservator because the court appointed. We lost thousands and thousands of dollars just through her mismanagement. Now, that can't be tolerated for 30, 40 years. One of the court visiting persons told me a case of a lawyer which had conservatorship of an old lady. Every month she had bills for medicine, nursing home, doctor. The lawyer paid those three bills, then made out a check to himself for $400. People objected, hey, that's a lot of money. He said, well, I normally charge $100 for writing a check. But there were only three. Oh, no, I had to write a check to myself. That's four. And he did this every month. This is what happens when they stay in court conservatorship. I'd like to get these people out of court conservatorship and conserve their life and their livelihood with the money that they have. That way we keep them off of welfare, and in general, the court, the trust officer is concerned with making money. And you've seen how your checks don't charge you at the banks. That's because they're investing the money. The checks issued by the trust company, a professional trust company, the money would be invested, and probably the checks would go out at much less costs.
Mr. Kopp, if I could break in, I want to put a question to Counsel Taylor, to have probing sort of my understanding of the issue you've raised to make sure that I've framed this correctly. Counsel, what the bill does is it allows the creation, supplemental trusts are created in any event, but that the only change being made by this law is that subject to these limitations, the trust creation of the trust can terminate the conservatorship. Mm-hmm. So the effect above $50,000 would be to have to, in that situation, to require that there be both a conservatorship and a trust. So there's, in effect, another layer of oversight. So that if we were to do what this Mr. Kopp was suggesting, to remove that limit of $50,000, the effect of that would be to permit the creation of a trust that terminates the conservatorship, thereby eliminating this other layer of oversight that exists through the conservatorship process.
Chair, members of the committee, just looking at the bill, the court may not approve a trust that has the effect of terminating the conservatorship unless the value of the conservatorship state, including the amount of the trust transfer, the trust does not exceed $50,000. So I believe you're correct.
Right. So,
that would be removing a layer of oversight.
Right. Right. Okay. Any questions to the committee from Mr. Kopp?
No, Mr. Chair, but I wouldn't mind hearing Mr. Gibbs' opinion of eliminating the $50,000.
Yeah. Why don't we excuse you, Mr. Kopp, and we'll bring Mr. Gibbs forward to comment on this question.
Chairman Pearson, Representative Bonamici, the suggestion of eliminating the $250,000 limit, eliminating the $50,000 limit, I believe goes beyond what the elder law section was looking to do. The concern is not to eliminate all conservatorship cases in favor of supplemental needs trusts. The concern really is to provide a way to terminate those conservatorships in cases where the numbers don't really justify it. If you have less than $50,000 in a conservatorship estate, which is transferred into a supplemental needs trust, and you've got $2,000 or $3,000 a year in attorney fees and more in conservators' fees to manage these funds, then it really doesn't make sense to the individual to continue with those administrative costs. If you've got $200,000 or $300,000 or more, then the estate can bear those administrative expenses, and the amount of money that's there justifies the additional protection of having court supervision and immediate court response upon filing an objection to an accounting, rather than if the conservatorship is closed and we have a supplemental needs trust, and even if the trustee does provide an accounting and there's malfeasance within that accounting or shown within the accounting, the beneficiary or somebody on their behalf goes and gets an attorney, files a court case for review of the administration of the supplemental needs trust, you may be a year or longer beyond that initial accounting that's provided before the matter ever gets before the court. So when we're talking about amounts that are fairly significant, the conservator slash trustee files their accounting, and if there's any evidence of malfeasance, that is brought before the court immediately. So the elder law section's proposal was to limit it to $50,000, so we don't look at all conservatorships as open to being closed down just for the purpose of creating supplement or just through the mechanism of creating a supplemental needs trust.
Thank you.
And did I correctly frame the issue in my question to counsel a moment ago? That is, the effect of having the $50,000 limit is to preserve then the conservatorship layer of oversight for those larger situations, right?
Yes, Chairman Pearson.
Very good. Any other questions?
No, I don't really have a question. Maybe it's a question. Under the way the statute is drafted, in the situation raised by Mr. Kopp of a conservator who is not acting properly, that I don't think is going to be remedied by this bill, because this relies on the conservator making the decision to establish the trust anyway. Is that a correct interpretation?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici. Yes, if a conservator is acting inappropriately, then that should be identified at the time an annual accounting is filed. If the individual can remain on public benefits, then the conservator should pursue the supplemental needs trust, transfer the funds in, and then decide whether or not this fits within whatever guidelines may be enacted to terminate the conservatorship and simply just have the trust then. In cases where you have conservator malfeasance or trustee malfeasance, if the conservator case is still open, then the court's going to have immediate oversight. If the conservatorship has been closed and we just have the supplemental needs trust, then again, there is a mechanism to pursue the trustee for malfeasance. But again, we're talking about smaller dollar amounts.
Representative Forrest?
Thank you. I think it's also helpful, Mr. Gibb, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in the conservatorship proceeding, when an accounting is filed, that also accounting is distributed to heirs and other interested parties for their review and comment period. So if there is a set suspicion of malfeasance, then they have an opportunity to comment on that. Oftentimes what our experience has been is that people find objection to attorney time to do some of the routine activities that are billed in conjunction with an accounting, and it might be the premise from which Mr. Kopp is speaking.
Thank you, Representative Forrest.
Any further questions or comments? Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gibb, you, in your testimony just now, you said large accounts, 200 or 300,000. Why are we not pushing the limit up there to $200,000 or $300,000 if $50,000 is a small amount?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, the intent of the elder law section was really to request that a fairly limited number of these cases be allowed to be, the conservatorship cases be allowed to be closed in favor of the supplemental needs trust. $50,000 was not necessarily an arbitrary number, but it was a number that was chosen because larger amounts seemed too large. I guess I'll put it that way. If you have $200,000 or $300,000 in a conservatorship, and that money is transferred into supplemental needs trust, again, if that money is invested, then it's likely that if there's some return on that money, it's going to help cover the administrative expenses of administering the conservatorship and the trust combined. If the trustee and conservator are charging huge amounts, then the court still has the ability to change who the trustee and conservator are, as long as the conservatorship case is open. The concern really is to make sure that we're not allowing large sums of money to be transferred out of the court's purview. But in cases where the administrative burden outweighs the amount of money that's there, to allow those cases to be moved out of the court's purview so we can stretch out the duration that money is going to last that person.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I'll excuse Mr. Gibb.
Thank you.
And we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2360 and open a work session on House Bill 2360. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask Representative Forrest for her opinion, because thank you so much for your expertise in this area. It's obvious you've done some work in this area. What do you think about the $50,000 limit? Does that make sense, or, and to the other members, too?
Mr. Chair, might I comment?
Please.
Thank you. And just for background, I did work for a sole practitioner for 18 and a half years who did probate, guardianships, and conservatorships, and so it's an area that I do have some experience. I think that the limit of $50,000 probably is a good thing, and not to go to the higher levels, primarily for that opportunity for court oversight, because the conservatorship would remain in place. We did have experiences also with creating the special needs trust for individuals who were placed in institutions so that they could continue to receive their supplemental Social Security income and help preserve those assets. And it is kind of a check and balance to leave the conservatorship in place when there are the larger figures. So I think the $50,000 is a reasonable level, in my understanding of this, so as not to deplete the assets with the ongoing requirement for a conservatorship accounting on an annual basis and ongoing attorney fees, depleting the amount that's available to the recipient.
Thank you.
Senator Krieger.
Couples are sitting here kind of not certain we understand this thing totally. We haven't talked about the administrative costs. Who determines that? And you're saying the court's going to keep that in line?
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to infer that. The accounting, usually a conservatorship, a person has come in and retained the services of an attorney, and the file remains within the purview of the attorney for the person that's been appointed the conservator for protected persons. And the conservator is responsible to do certain things and pay bills for the benefit of the protected person. All the time, yes, incurring attorney fees when the file is reviewed, when the attorney is advising the conservator on certain areas when needed. Those are attorney rates charged at 0.1 increment. Tenth of an hour increments divide up their hourly rate. And so, again, oftentimes that is a point of contention for certain people who are concerned about what the attorney fee charge is in the whole thing. But attorneys also are doing oversight for their clients. That's not established by the court.
If there's no further general discussion on the bill, are people comfortable with the motion on House Bill 2360?
I still have some concerns, Mr. Chair, but I would probably vote for it, not saying I will on the floor.
Okay.
I'm still concerned about the guidelines. I mean, that's, we got that from lawyers that the bill doesn't, you know, provide any oversight. I'll vote to move it out of committee, but I still think we need more input. Or I don't understand why Mr. Kopp's the only one here representing the people. I don't know why ACLU's not here representing the people on this issue.
I think there may be a misunderstanding about just what this bill is doing. The conservatorship mechanism provides oversight about how a person who is not competent to manage their own affairs, it provides judicial oversight. The court has to there have to be filings with the court, and the court has to approve expenditures on behalf of the person who is the subject of the conservatorship. And the only thing this bill does is it permits, when a supplemental trust, special needs trust, is being created, it allows that to replace the conservatorship form of oversight for the smaller conservatorship arrangements. So that's why it's capped at $50,000. So there may be broader questions about whether one thinks that conservatorships properly, you know, doing the right job by people, or they're too expensive, or, I mean, those are other policy questions. But this bill is very narrowly saying that for those small conservatorships, we can allow the trust mechanism to replace the conservatorship.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I see it as a sort of, they're serving dual roles in a sense. The conservator who has been appointed and the trustee. And for estates, for accounts less than this certain amount, $50,000, is it worthwhile to pay the conservator and to pay fees to the trustee for oversight of these funds? It seems to me that it's a good thing to say, for that amount, we don't need to have both a court-appointed conservator and a trustee managing these funds on behalf of the person. We should have a trustee, because otherwise too much is going to be spent in fees for both the conservator and the trustee, but for above $50,000, then we say, okay, we need the oversight of having the conservator and the trustee for this trust. So it seems to me to be an efficiency and to save money for the benefit of the incapacitated person, because more of the funds will be going to provide care and what and to pay for the needs of the incapacitated person, because you aren't also paying for a conservator when you have the trustee.
Mr.
Does that
Chair.
Help at all or muddy the waters?
I think so.
Yes, Representative Wisman.
Mr. Chair, what is the Oregon Uniform Trust Code? Does Mrs. Susan know that? What? That's what this letter says. If the courts don't do this, then the Oregon Uniform Trust Code will go a long way in providing these such safeguards.
Ms. Gravy and Mr. Gibb. Why don't you just give us a little bit of background then here in work session on the Oregon Uniform Trust Code.
Susan Gravy with Oregon State Bar, and I will be extremely brief. But the Oregon Uniform Trust Code was a very large proposal that worked its way through the system last session. It worked through its way through both judiciary committees, and it was the product, the end result of 2 years of numerous entities coming together, the Bankers Association, the State Bar, Estate Planning Section, Elder Law Section, many, many different entities over a two-year time period worked together to make sure that the Uniform Trust Code was crafted for the state of Oregon. The provisions are numerous, they're complicated, and I would never be able to go through all of them, and you don't want to take the time to do that here today, I suspect. But Ryan could answer any more specific questions if you had them. Thank you.
Is there a need for any further input on that point?
Mr. Cobb said, it doesn't make sense to me, a non-lawyer, that you charge an estate $100 to write yourself a check. His example he gave. That seems like that's abuse. Is that covered in this system?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnant, nobody gets paid anything until the court has had an opportunity to review it and approves it. In cases of a conservatorship, if there is a conservator who is charging $100 per check to write checks, I would expect somebody, if not an individual, a family member, somebody to object, then I would expect the court to object on their own and not allow that. I would consider that an excessive fee. A lot of professional conservatorships, especially or professional fiduciaries, especially, will have a flat rate for what they do. I know there's one who is very active here in Salem who charges, I think, a flat rate of $5 per check. His staff enters that, cuts the check, and keeps a reconciliation of those. And so there are systems in place, and those systems have set costs, and those costs are reviewed before anybody gets paid. In a case like that, again, I would see that as abusive. To the extent that a conservatorship may be closed in favor of a supplemental needs trust, as proposed in the bill, again, you brought up the Oregon Uniform Trust Code. The Uniform Trust Code says that all trusts in the state of Oregon have certain protections for the beneficiaries, and a beneficiary can get a report or an accounting on the trust. A beneficiary or somebody who's known as a qualified beneficiary, I won't go into what that is, but there are several classifications of individuals who can come back to the court and question what the trustee has done. So the reference to the Oregon Uniform Trust Code in Mr. Heinrich's letter really explains that even if this is taken out of the purview of a conservatorship and the direct court oversight, there's still protections built into the statute that govern the supplemental needs trust itself, even outside of a conservatorship. Again, the concern with the dollar amounts and not just letting much larger conservatorships be converted into a supplemental needs trust is that bringing that action for review of the trustee's action under the Uniform Trust Code can take a lot longer, and in the meantime, a lot more of those funds can go out the door. Therefore, for conservatorships larger than $50,000, the Elder Law Section is not asking that the statute be changed with regards to those, only with regards to these smaller amounts where it may be much more necessary to immediately cut off or immediately review the conservator and trustee's use of those funds.
Any further questions of these witnesses while we're here in work session? See any? So we are still in work session. Are people comfortable with action on this bill today, or do they want to let this one rest for a bit? Or do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2360 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 2360 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Conk?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisman?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye.
House Bill 2360 is moved to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. I close the work session of House Bill 2360. Committee members and those in the audience, we are now coming at the end of our ordinary time, and we are due on the floor at 10:45. We have two other bar bills. Oh, and Representative Flores, would you carry that last bill 2360 for us? That would be
Thank
a
you.
Great service to the chamber, I think, if you'd help us understand it.
We might have a few questions on the floor.
Yeah.
Watch them
bumping
the chair.
I want to get some guidance from folks in the audience. Unfortunately, we've used up our time here, and we had Mr. Wachter from the estate planning section on both House Bills 2361 and 2362, and Mr. Darris on House Bill 2362. Gentlemen, Mr. Darris, I know that you come from Multnomah County. Mr. Wachter, are you from a distance as well? Would it be a great inconvenience if we could set them Monday when we have a relatively shorter agenda and we could assure you that they would get on, or if there's another day that would work better for you since you came all this way today?
Let's try. Chair, I have a 10:30. I have to.
Yeah, we're gonna lose our quorum is our problem. Monday would be all right. I beg your pardon. We'll start that prompt at 8:30, and we'll take those bills up first if that works all right for you, gentlemen. Okay. Thank you very much. Actually, no. I think the President's Day is a week after that. This would be the 12th. Monday the 12th. Before you disappear, committee, there's an announcement here from...
Chairman of the Committee, we have seven bills on this committee on the floor today, and staff would be glad to be there, but if you could let us know in advance if you need our help, we'd appreciate it. If you don't need our help, we have work in the office to do, but we'd be glad to be down there. I see you, Representative... Almost everyone on the committee has a bill, and we will be there, but if you don't need us, let us know, okay?
I think I'm okay.
Okay.
Thank you, though.
Okay, and recall at 8 a.m. tomorrow, we're headed out to the Department of Public Safety Training. Please join me then.
Should we dress casual for that?
I'd say to your own comfort. That's fine. Okay. We are adjourned. Okay,